We're happy to make podcasts available for selected EdWebinars for your listening pleasure. If you'd like to receive a CE certificate, you must watch the video recording. Recordings and quizzes can be found in the EdWebinar archives. Please visit home.edweb.net/podcasts for more information.
Liesl, thank you very, very much for joining me. I'm super excited for the next hour, so thank you.
My pleasure. I'm excited too.
So I'm with Exemplars. I'm Jay Meadows, but that's really not what we're here for. So we're the ones hosting this. But you, Ms. Liesl, are really why we're here. I host this series of webinars. I call them Problem Solving with Exemplars. And that's a play on word because I think of you as my exemplar. I invited you because I have a problem that I'm trying to understand, and I know other teachers are trying to understand it. So I wanted to invite you to come help us solve this problem. And the problem is really about, there's all of this cognitive neuroscience, right? There's this research that's out there, and there's big fancy words that people throw around. And I want us to understand what that means for us as teachers. But my first question is, why did you get into this in the first place? What drew you to studying the brain and math?
Because I had a problem and I wanted to solve it. Right? So, I mean, I was one of those people who knew early on in life that I wanted to be a teacher. And probably some of the people who are listening or watching this also played school when they were little, like I did. And I first recorded I wanted to be a teacher when I was in third grade. And so I quickly moved through my education experience, and I found myself teaching high school math at the age of 20. I'm not sure how they let me into a high school classroom at age 20. And I was so excited. I was so eager. I had all these great ideas and all this love and passion for teaching and for math and for students. And that first year was just rough. Mm-hmm. It was really rough. And I was struggling and failing and was just really not enjoying myself all that much. And I remember thinking, like, I don't know what else to do. Like, I have wanted to be a math teacher since I was 8 years old. And this is all I've ever wanted to do. All I've ever wanted to do. And I've been dreaming of it for so long that I was unwilling to step aside and to go and pursue a different career. And so instead I thought, okay, what do I need to understand? What do I need to know to be able to do this better? Because my students, some of them were learning math, some of them weren't. Some were motivated, some were not. Some were remembering things, some were not. And I was like, this whole learning thing is a lot more complicated than I thought it was. And because it just wasn't happening the same way it had happened for me. And so I said, okay, I need to understand how this whole learning thing happens. And so that's where my obsession with learning began. I was like, I need to learn about learning. And how do you learn about learning? Is you understand the brain. That is the organ that is most responsible for learning. So I dove in to studying how the brain learns and what conditions it needs to be able to learn well. And I'm still
Story. I was a Peace Corps volunteer. No one had ever taught me how to teach. And I joked that I was the worst teacher on two continents simultaneously because it kind of sits in between Asia and Europe. And like I was not a gift to my students. I'll put it that way. But it launched a pursuit. Like I was like, I really want to get good at this. So the origin story, you know, sometimes it doesn't start off the best.
God, so, I mean, we're all learning.
So now you've embarked in this journey, right? About teaching and learning and how we frame things. And when we first started talking, I thought this is what we'd spend our hour talking about was dendrites, right? Because learning is all about growing new dendrites. But you quickly brought my attention to the realization that there's a lot going on in the brain and in the person that is really important for us to understand around education beyond just these cool dendrites and axons and all that. And so the first thing that you said was really important for us to understand is this idea of the math identity. This has been sort of in your 25 years kind of where you've said, this is really interesting. So unpack what you mean by this for us. What are you researching?
Okay. So I'm just going to go back to this right here. So after about 20 years in education is when Dr. Jensen and I first published this book right here, Brain-Based Learning, which is the science of how learning happens and the conditions needed for learning to happen well. It goes into motivation, emotion, all sorts of great topics in there. But as I continue to dive deeper and deeper in trying to understand how learning happens, I realized that in the conversations around the science of learning, we often forget the humanity of the learner. And simultaneously, people are really deep into talking about the humanity of the learner. And in those conversations, I think sometimes the science of learning is missing from those conversations. So I live this unique existence where I kind of have a foot in both worlds around the science of learning and the humanity of the learner. And those two are actually very connected in terms of how learning happens for a person. So we could talk about axons and dendrites and synaptic gaps and things like that. But what matters first for learning to happen in a math context is how the student sees themselves in relationship to math. And that's what I call their math identity. And their math identity, it's a relationship. We all have a relationship with math. And just like we have relationships with, you know, different people, and we have a relationship with math. And it's that relationship that opens the doors for the brain to be able to do the beautiful things that it can do, or to close the doors for too many of our students right now to not be able to do the things they do. Because when students believe, oh, math is not my thing, I'm not a math person, my family, like we just don't do math, that literally does things neurologically to the brain that impairs deep, meaningful learning to happen.
So how does a student's math identity get formed? When does that start, and who's responsible, and how does that start?
So that's the question I first started asking myself a handful of years ago. It was like, okay, so how does this whole thing form? Because I heard people starting to talk about it, and so much of the conversation around math identity is focusing on the individual and what they're doing. So it's like growth mindset posters and affirmations, wonderful things that have great validity. But as I dug into the research, I realized that it's so much more. So the quick version is that math identity, I mean, it's always being formed. It's always forming. It's always changing. Because of neuroplasticity, the brain is always and constantly changing. And so is our identity, how we see ourselves in math. And so there's actually these four main elements that contribute to the formation of someone's math identity. And one of them is getting a lot of focus right now out in the education conversation. The other three, I worry, are getting neglected. And we need a balanced approach. So we can really dive into the neuroscience of like where identity is formed in the brain. And we can talk about the ventromedial prefrontal cortex, and the dorsal medial prefrontal cortex, and how those different regions of the brain form our identity and how we see ourselves in the context of math. But for people who really want a deeper dive into that, I have a whole separate webinar that goes into the brain science of math identity formation. I'm just going to give a quick overview here and say there's four main factors that contribute to a student's math identity. One of them is in relationship to time. And that's because there is a region of the prefrontal cortex of the brain that is responsible for identity formation in relationship to time. So our past experiences, everything we've experienced in math in the past, contributes to how I see myself now. This is pretty easy for teachers to recognize. And so it's helpful to know how have they experienced math in the past? Who have they had as their teachers? How has that experience been like for them? And to give space for students to share about that and to talk about that, because they might be bringing anxiety or trauma with them into your classroom. That's important to know so you know how to deal with it. The other side of the time factor is their future. Now, the future hasn't happened yet, and yet it plays a critical part in how they see themselves now. That's because if a student looks to their future, looks and tries to see themselves grown up, if they can't see people like them out there in math-related fields, killing it, doing awesome things, things that are interesting and inspiring to them, then it's hard for them to see themselves with a positive math identity because, well, there's nobody else like me doing that. So how do I fit in into a math world beyond the four walls of a school classroom? Because math is personal.
I think that's so fascinating too, Lisa. So this idea that, like, thinking about myself and my relationship with math and what's it mean to me? Like, what value does that have for me? And mm-hmm. and being able to inspire students to find the value in mathematics is such an interesting responsibility of teachers. And we'll unpack it a little bit more later. So
yeah. So we have their past experience and future, which a lot of it is around representation and belongingness in math spaces. And then there's the other two factors, and these are go to your question of like, who's responsible for it? We're putting way too much responsibility on the individual student because there are so many structural and systemic forces that are forming our students' math identity. I call them the social cultural forces. Those would be things like the parents' influence. This would be even the teacher's bias, how the teacher perceives certain students and their ability in math. This could be the messages that society says about who is good at math and what does it mean to be good at math. Those are very clearly defined by our society, that certain genders, certain cultures, certain races are better at math than others. And that's false. It's not true. Mm-hmm. But these messages are still out here and the media pushes them. And so much of our curriculum and our schools push them. And we need to be able to like pull the curtain behind from those things and be able to speak out loud to them and say, hold on a second. Did you see that clip? Like, we're going to watch a 2-minute clip from this teen movie, Mean Girls. And we're going to watch and identify all of the messages that are unhealthy that relate to mathematics. Like, that's a good use of watching a movie in school, a 2-minute clip from Mean Girls, and you can unpack a lot or plenty of other sources of media. So there's all of these other forces. And then there is the personal aspect, and that goes into the student's self-efficacy, their own confidence and competence as relates to math. So there's a lot to unpack here. And some teachers can get really overwhelmed, like, oh my gosh, I can barely even keep up with my own content. How could I possibly be able to also help build my students' math identity? I don't have time for that. I don't know how to do that. And so because of that, I have created resources for teachers. I have 12 specific activities that create a balanced approach for all four of these factors, ready-made activities that really help students to heal and to form a positive math identity, because that's where it really starts.
And I want to let everybody who's watching know that at the very end of the show, we'll share a link that will have all of those resources as a webpage. And all of the resources we talk about tonight will be present. And we'll send it to you tomorrow as well as sort of a follow-up. So good incentive to click and open it up. So what do you do as a teacher? And I recognize like that student's relationship with mathematics is not great. And I, as a fifth grade teacher, I would tell students, you know, I grew up severely dyslexic. So for me, reading was the real issue. And I would tell that story the first day of school and be like, if your relationship with math is kind of like mine with reading, just give me a little heads up, like, Mr. Mills, I'm not so good at math, or I don't really like math. And the number of kids who would whisper to me over the next 2 days, like, I don't really like math, Mr. Meadows. Fifth graders, they're 10 years old and they already don't like math.
I know.
What do we do as teachers when we encounter those kids? Because we have them in our rooms. What are your thoughts?
Well, one, we need to listen. We need to listen and understand where that's coming from so we can help them heal from that. Because, and there's so many ways to do that. That, you know, through writing activities, they can write you a quick letter, a journal activity. I even do it through art. I have students create a picture called Mathland. Draw a picture of a planet called Mathland, where math rules everything. And it's fascinating because I'll have students who will come back with a picture of this beautiful, symmetrical landscape with flowers and rainbows and, you know, rivers and all this beautiful things. And then others create this horrible, like, war zone of, you know, death land of, you know, horrible, like, robots dragging kids to school, punish this kid for not doing their math homework. And so there's ways to help students, you know, when relationships exist. Of course, we always want to start with a really strong foundation of relationships to create that safety and that trust between you and the student to share, to help understand where it's coming from. And these are activities that are all scripted out in that resource that I'll be sharing, we'll be sharing later. And then it's just every single day, little by little, working to help them build a better math identity. And it begins with us as teachers. We have to do our own work to believe, to really, really believe, because our own bias is so strong. We have to believe that every single student in our classroom is capable of learning math at high levels, which is neurologically 100% true. And when we come in with that, then we invest in those, you know, through the lens of equity, we invest in those who need it most to help them build that. We celebrate their successes. We help craft small, simple successes so they get that hit of dopamine, that high of rewards and success of being successful at math in really small, simple ways. And then we build on that. We don't wait till the chapter test to see, oh gosh, I hope they got a decent grade because I know that's going to, you know, impact their math identity so much. It's like, no, every student should be leaving your classroom every single day high on dopamine. Mm-hmm. I know it's a little bit of a reference, but you know, you get what I'm saying. Like they need to feel like, oh my gosh, I got this.
And the next question is kind of delicate, but where does that negative math identity come from? Like how much of it happens in the classroom? How much of it happens at home? Like what are some things maybe us educators can be thinking about to reframe so that we're creating a positive math identity with our students?
I mean, it's coming from everywhere. Like once you start thinking about it and once you start looking for it, it's just everywhere. You see, it could be coming from home. Mm-hmm. And sometimes their students are getting really strong messages from home about their math identity. I open books with my children, like with my six-year-old, these little like level A reading books, and there's messages in there. They're subtle. Mm-hmm. They're subtle. And some people think like, oh, come on, Lisa, like that's just really, that just flies under the radar. They don't really notice it. But when you really understand how the brain works, 90% of the inputs that we receive in our brain come at the unconscious level. Mm-hmm. And so it's like, oh yeah, come on. Like that, you know, yeah, they said that lyric in the song or that one line in that movie. But the reality is that when we are constantly receiving these messages and seeing images of math being portrayed as being hard and stressful for marketing or advertising reasons, then it just adds up. It just adds up. Like you think about from a neuroscience perspective, like we talk about the old Hebb's postulate, neurons that fire together, wire together. And we use that to understand the importance of repetition and review so we can retain information. That the more we practice something, you know, we use this for deliberate practice, the stronger those neural networks are going to be. The same principle applies for our affective relationship with math, our emotional relationship with math. It's just like drops in the bucket that are just solidifying that relationship.
And this was a slide you shared. I think this is such an important idea for us to wrap our heads around. It's like there is an emotional response to mathematics. And if it's a positive emotion, then you'll have one student. And if you develop a negative emotion around mathematics, you probably have a very different student. I have to question just... what do you think about grading in terms of math identity? Do you have any research around that or thoughts?
Oh, I've got a lot of thoughts. How much time do we have, Jay?
As much as you want.
Okay, let me see if I can keep this brief around grading. So the brain is driven towards rewards and away from threats. And that's just how, it's an inherent principle of how the brain operates. And so however we reward people, that what happens when we receive a reward is that dopamine is released in the brain, and dopamine is that neurotransmitter that's highly associated with motivation. It's highly addictive. And so whenever we get that hit of dopamine, we want more of it. And so we naturally go back to whatever it was that was the initial source of the dopamine. And we want to replicate that to get more of that. A lot of the research from this actually does come out of drug culture, which is why I sometimes make those references. And so what that means for us as teachers in classrooms is that most school systems are built around rewarding students or threatening them through grades. And that is how we have created a system where students are addicted to grades and not to learning. Students are obsessed with grades. They'll do whatever it takes to get the A for whatever reason, to make themselves feel good, to get into the college they want to, for parental approval, for sports eligibility. They'll do whatever it takes because that's what the dopamine is attached to get the reward that they want, instead of it being connected to learning. And so, and then as teachers, we say, like, we complain that the kids are just obsessed with grades. All they do is they care about whatever they need to do to get the grade, and they don't really care about actual learning, when we have created and perpetuated a system that accomplishes that very thing.
One of the moments of grading I do wonder a lot about is early in a unit, you give an assessment, and it's still early and kids are still formulating their understanding. And yet we get it and we grade it and we put these big like red X's, or we show them like, oh, these are all wrong. It's like, well, what's that doing to a student's math identity in that moment where they're receiving a paper full of wrong, 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 wrong? Mm-hmm. How can we help our students be successful and motivate them to learn while also recognizing, like, you didn't get it right, but what are your thoughts?
Okay, so we're talking about two different things. One is talking about grades, and the other is talking about assessments. Okay. So assessments are necessary and important, especially like formative ones. And formative assessments can happen without any grades. It's just a way to measure the accuracy of our learning and our progress of our learning. And so, feedback is important and it's essential, but it's in like, how do we deliver it and where are they coming from in terms of their identity, their relationship with math, when they get that feedback, which is why I'm such a huge proponent of like daily formative feedback. Mm-hmm. Because if you wait till these big summative ones, it's just such a big hit. Right? It's like this big, like big, massive hammer. It's like a Thor style, right? It's a big Thor style, boom. It can be that just knocks them down big time. Whereas if it's an exit ticket at the end of the day, a quick little partner quiz, a quick little something at the end of the day to see if they have mastered the topic of the day, then it's like, oh, whoops. It's more of like a little tap. Instead of a big Thor hammer of like, okay, all right, I don't got this yet.
It's a great analogy.
You know, it feels different. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It feels a whole lot different because we've all experienced those Thor hammers.
Oh, yeah.
And it can hurt.
And if it's happening daily, it's more of a kind of a nudge or a point in the right direction versus you're right, that hammer that's just like, you're getting this all wrong.
Yeah.
Of course, I develop a math identity that isn't really positive with mathematics if that's my relationship. Like, oh, I'm just not very good at this.
Sure. And it has to do also with the culture in the classroom. If the teacher has created a culture around these assessments, that one, it's a way for the student to check in with themselves. Like, have I mastered this concept? But equally, this is feedback for the teacher. And if the students know, hey, not only is this, okay, so this is a reflection for me. I don't have this yet. But if they also recognize that this is a gift I'm giving back to my teacher that says, I don't have this yet. Mm-hmm. And if they know, well, and have enough experience with the teacher to trust their teacher to know that, like, hey, this, by me giving this to the teacher, I'm giving them a gift that says, hey, we don't got this yet. And I know my teacher is going to take care of me. And that tomorrow, they're not going to leave me behind and they're not going to move on. They're going to make sure that we all got this before we move on.
That's one of the best things I've heard in a while. I like that. That's right. It's a trust moment. Like, okay, teach. I don't think I know. Beautifully said. We did promise several secrets. I think we could live in this world right now forever, but I'm going to keep us going just to kind of continue. Because when I was reading your book, Brain-Based Learning, outstanding book, highly recommend anyone that reads it. And it's really readable too, which I loved.
Thank you.
You talk about the stages of learning, that there's sort of the beginning, which is readiness, sort of the heart of constructing new understanding, and then the consolidation. So I wanted to unpack these a little bit. Talk to me holistically about the three stages of learning to kind of get us started.
Yes. So just to tie this into what we're talking about with math identity is that the identity we bring into this process is going to help make this process work smoothly or really be bumpy or not work at all. So that's like identity is like that foundational piece here. Now, when we talk about learning, so often, at least I'll speak for myself. When I started teaching over 25 years ago, I thought, well, I just come in and I have my lesson plan and I teach my lesson and hopefully they learn it. And then off we go. I, you know, repeat, rinse, repeat the next day. And I didn't understand that there were almost like these bookends that most teachers, including myself, were unaware of and thus neglecting. Construction, that middle piece, is what we often think of as our typical lesson plan. Like we're teaching and we're trying to construct new neural pathways in the brain. But in order for that to happen, the brain has to be ready. The brain has to be ready to learn. You can't force people to learn something. They have to be ready. And then the consolidation piece is how do we get it in the brain so that it stays and that it sticks so that it can be useful in the future. So here's what I'd like to say about each one of these phases right here is that the readiness phase is all about getting the brain drooling to learn. If not, it's all wasted. And the reality is that most students walk into a math classroom not ready to learn.
Yep.
They're not.
It's almost like we need to get them to want to learn. Yes. And believe it or not, how do we get them to want to learn math? Right. And there are ways, and I've seen them and I've seen teachers, and your research shows that there are ways to get kids who really are curious. And we'll unpack that a little bit.
Yeah. We're going to unpack a bunch of those, some real simple, easy tools. But the reality is that students don't walk into your class ready to learn math. And if we ignore that phase and we try to just jump and leapfrog it, then we start feeling like we're talking to a brick wall. They don't learn. We have to reteach it 13 times. All the challenges that we don't enjoy about teaching that don't connect us to what inspired us to become a teacher. And, you know, I like to share the example. Like, I mean, you think about readiness. I mean, how often have you had a student walk into your math class and say, hey, you know, Mr. Meadows, you know, I just really couldn't sleep last night because I just couldn't stop thinking about, you know, how you were talking about yesterday, we were talking about like quadratics and like the coefficient and like when it gets bigger, you know, the quadratic goes like this. I was just curious, like what happens if the lead coefficient of a quadratic is a fraction? You know, that is a student who's ready to learn. But that, I mean, I have in 25 years of being in education, I've yet to have that happen. It doesn't happen naturally for most students. If you've experienced that, those of you who are listening, wow, treasure those moments. So we need to prompt it. And it's way easier than most of us think. So we prompt the readiness. Construction is all about building the new learning based on the brain's systems and capacity. And that's the key there, is that the brain needs to be paying attention. There are limited capacities to the brain. It's amazing, but it does have its limits. And this is where people start talking about cognitive load and working memory and, you know, people's like, oh, you, those moments where you're at, you know, minute 52 of your 57 minute class period, or those of you who teach in elementary, it's like towards the end of the day and the kids are like glazed over and you're like, come on. Can you stick with me? Like five more minutes. Can you stick with me for five more minutes? And they're like, okay. But they're gone. They're gone. And that's because so many times as a teacher, I've been guilty of trying to get my students to change to fit my schedule versus us being willing to adjust the way we invite students to learn to match the natural systems of the brain. The attentional systems of the brain has some natural like ebbs and flows. It's all mapped out in the book of like how long we typically can pay attention to. Most teachers know this from experience, as well as how much they can hang on to without working memory capacity. So that's what construction is about. Consolidation is just making sure that it's retained and that it's retained correctly. Because forgetting is one issue, but some people remember things, but they remember it incorrectly. Right. It's like, oh, wait, do I need a common denominator when I'm adding and subtracting, or is it when I'm multiplying or dividing? And some kids, they get that mixed up, and there's real simple reasons as to why that happens and even simpler solutions.
All right, Lisa, let's unpack each one of those. But I'm going to use the chat feature. I'm going to prompt people. What do you think are three readiness tools that we can use to prime the brain, right? And your book has several, and we'll see if what people.
This is perfect. So this is like a simple example. So here we have a slide. The brain has three hardwired readiness tools, which means it's just inherent properties of the brain that if students are in either any of these neurological states, they're feeling any of these things, 1, 2, 3 icons, then it naturally prompts the motivational systems of the brain and for students to be ready. Like we talk so often about, students just aren't motivated to learn math. What we're really saying from a cognitive neuroscience perspective is that the student isn't neurologically ready to learn math. It's readiness.
Is it engagement? Because I hear a lot of teachers across the country talk about my students just aren't engaging in class, or is it bigger than that?
No, it's both of that. Like being ready. I mean, we're talking about a few things. We're talking about neurobiological states. So what that means is that we're always in some kind of state. Sometimes we're in a state of being confident or being hopeless, anxious, curious, like hungry, tired, like however you're feeling in this brief moment, that's your neurobiological state. And every state comes with a unique signature cocktail of neurotransmitters and hormones and chemicals that are released in the brain that activate different systems and do all these magical things in the brain. We're not going to get into the details right here. And some of those help and enhance learning, and some of them hurt and make it more difficult to learn. These three right here are inherent. These are like your power tools right here. If you can get students into any of these states right here, then they will be primed and ready for learning. So in the chat, people are dropping their ideas. These are little icons. And that's why we do it. We do it this way because this is one simple tool to like withhold information to help people get motivated or engaged. We ready for the big reveal? I know, right?
All right, everybody ready?
Before we go there, Jay, before we reveal it, let's just pause and make this be a real tangible takeaway for teachers, because this would be like an anchor chart for me. And if like we were doing PD together, so when I do a lot of professional development with schools all over the world, we would talk about this really, really in depth and go into a lot more than we're doing right now. And what I would do is I would share this right here as an anchor chart before we get into it with the labels missing. So in a second, we're going to get the labels for these three icons. Those of you who are listening on the podcast, we have three icons right here on the screen. One is like a little magician's hat, one is a clock, and one is kind of a heart in the shape of a puzzle piece, but there's no labels for them. And so when we talk about anchor charts that we use in our classroom, which are wonderful, powerful tools, we often talk about using them after our lesson as a reinforcement or a review strategy. But a simple, simple strategy is to to post an incomplete anchor chart a few days or a week before you get to the lesson to foster the readiness. I'll talk more about that later, but here's the big three.
You ready?
I'm ready.
See, I'm excited. Like, I know what the answers are, and I'm like, come on.
Well, that's because, I mean, a few things like dopamine and norepinephrine are like rushing through your body and brain right now and for everyone else. And that's what we want, because when those are rushing through our brain, then it's like the glue that's going to stick this learning together for us. So here we go. Big reveal. Drum roll, please.
Somebody gave us a thumb down. I think that they wanted them. Okay.
Boom. So here we go. Now, here's the big three.
I find these fascinating because there's been a ton of research recently around curiosity about how valuable this is. And then there's this idea of relevance. We could spend hours unpacking both. Talk to me about what is curiosity and why is that valuable in our classroom?
Curiosity is so valuable because the brain it's a predictive organ. The brain is designed to predict outcomes. Because the brain's designed for survival and not for formal academic learning. We created this thing called school and we use the brain in it, but the brain is really designed to keep us alive and physically as well as socially. And so curiosity really taps into the predictive nature of the brain, because if I have an incomplete anchor chart on the wall, if I have some type of prop sitting on a stool in front of the class, if I have a question written on the board when my students come in, if I like all of these really simple tools, that is prompting the brain to predict, what is that? What is it for? What does it mean? What are we going to do with that? And because the brain needs it for survival, it has learned to try to anticipate and predict what it's used for, what's going to happen next, then you're just really tapping into the brain's natural power. And you just have full attention and they're right there with you.
I think of curiosity as that gap between what I know and what I want to know. Mm. But I have to want it. And I love that idea of the brain as a survival tool. So how do we make math help someone's survival? Right.
Yep.
And to me, that's kind of then tag teams with relevance.
Exactly.
So unpack this idea of relevance and how do we do that in a math classroom?
Yeah. So I remember being a young teacher, early 20s, being so annoyed with students who would say in my math class, middle school class, high school math class, why do we have to learn this? When am I ever going to use this? And I don't think I'm the only teacher who has heard students say that. And I used to be so annoyed by them. But now I think they're one of the most wise students in the room, because they are literally asking for what their brain is craving. Mm-hmm. If you can just tell me why this is important to me, because the brain naturally gives focus and attention and energy to things it finds relevant. They want to know the relevance because that is going to help them pay attention. It's going to help them learn. It's going to help them give effort towards this thing that we're learning. And so relevance is just such a powerful strategy to get students ready to learn. And this is why you see so many real world problems out there that people are using. There's so many ways to build relevance with math. And I will just say that I acknowledge that there are some standards in our content standards that make it really, really tough to do that.
I remember being a teacher and I would get that question early in my career. When am I ever going to use this in the real world? And at first I used to really dread that question because I didn't know the answer sometimes, right? As I got better at teaching math and I spent more time, I was like, well, here's a moment for dividing with fractions and, but as I realized, like, if I don't answer that question, and if my students haven't internalized the answer of what's in it for me, the brain has way more things that it wants to do than pay attention to a math class.
Yep.
So until I've answered that question, what's in it for me, it's almost on me as the teacher to sort of answer that question and begin a class with these to get my students to buy in. Like, okay, I'll lean in today, Mr. Miller. This sounds good.
100%. Because if the brain is deciding, where am I going to divert my attention systems of the brain to? What's happening on Instagram or what's happening here with, you know, factoring these binomials? That's a really easy choice for the brain to make.
Right.
Really easy. Which is why sometimes when it's hard to find the natural relevance in math, which I recognize can be hard, that's what we borrow. We borrow relevance from other topics. We borrow relevance from Instagram. You know, it's like when everyone got so excited recently when Taylor Swift finally gave relevance to the math problem of, if a plane leaves Tokyo at 11 p.m., you know, will she make it to the Super Bowl in time to like that whole thing. And so I am constantly working with my students who are amazing at this to connect something that they already know a lot and care a lot about to what we're learning about in math. And when I work with schools, I share so many examples of how we do that and the beautiful ways my students have come up with those on their own. Because neurologically, what's happening, I'll give you 20 seconds, is that you have this like new complicated content that you're trying to like construct into the brain. But then if you can find a way to connect it to something that they have this beautiful, deep, rich, meaningful learning around, whether it's sports or a music or something cultural for them, you're literally tapping into like this power surge cord of so much brain power that really helps it stick so much more.
Peter Haas, asked a question early in the seminar. I hope we're answering his question around the importance of context. Is that what we're kind of getting at, is this idea of creating context for the math questions we're asking, finding ways to make it sort of real world?
That's part of what relevance can be, is to putting it in some kind of context, because learning doesn't really happen in isolation. It happens in social settings. It happens in some kind of context. Like I said, we created this thing called school, where we like go into the building and we learn something random that day. But if we can put it in the context of something, which is why so many people enjoy doing like project-based learning, where it becomes something that's part of something else. So it's not like this isolated floating random thing.
All right, teachers. So your responsibility when you start a class is, how are you going to get your kids curious? How are you going to make it valuable to them? Like, you got to flip that switch. Now you're the expert, but I've actually heard that there's a chemical released in a state of curiosity that's actually required in order to grow. I'm going to use the word dendrites in our brains. Is that true, that there's some real power chemically about a state of curiosity?
Say that again.
Okay. I was doing some research and I read, and I can't remember which of the dopamines, cortisols, all those, which one it was, but it was indicating that those curiosity chemicals that are released in a state of curiosity actually need to be present in order to grow new dendrites. Might be getting too far down a rabbit hole for us, but
I get a little bit worried about words like required. Okay. I would need to think about that more, but definitely when you're in a state of curiosity, dopamine is released more so in the state of curiosity than when you actually get the answer. So often we talk about dopamine as like what's released when we experience success, and that's that reward chemical, but dopamine is actually released in higher levels in the state of curiosity, which I think is a beautiful feature. So I want to give the teacher something really, really tangible, because we're talking really like deeply about neurobiology right here, is that one of the resources that you will be receiving is, is this right here. These are these three one-pagers that go through and give more depth to these three hardwired motivators: curiosity, anticipation, relevance. There are specific strategies, really simple stuff. There's really elaborate stuff out there in the world, but I love giving teachers really simple, no prep needed strategies. And then also, it's almost like sentence stems of what I have here, of just phrases that you can habituate into your language patterns that can prompt these types of neurobiological states to get students ready and motivated to learn.
We'll be sharing a link at the very end that will have all of these resources. Okay. We're running on, trying to get through some time stuff here. So let's get to construction.
Yep.
Right. Let's do again. All right. Predict. What are three elements of construction of learning that we can intentionally sort of incorporate into our classrooms? So we're just going to give a few seconds because there's so much to talk about. Time keeps moving.
Three tools or principles that enhance the construction of new learning in the brain.
You're really good at this.
And we're just going to highlight one, right, Jay?
Yeah. Yep. All right. Just for the sake of time, let's keep moving. So unpack these for us, Liesl.
So mindful learning is just like being present and being mindful of what you're learning. Chunking is all about cognitive load and the working memory capacity of the brain, and keeping learning things in small pieces and not overwhelming the working memory system. And multisensory is like what the image says here, which is just, it's not learning styles. What it is that the brain best learns when we experience it through as many senses as possible. That's just how we experience life, a multisensory experience. And too much of our instruction in classrooms, I believe, is monosensory. We're just kind of like talking at kids too much.
So what are some multisensory opportunities? What's your research suggest?
So the three main channels in a classroom setting that we can tap into are your visual tools, your auditory tools, and those motor tactile tools. I like to talk about the revolution that MTV created in for music, right? So in the chat, who remembers when MTV first came about? Like, we're talking old school MTV when it really was music television.
The good old days.
The heck it is now. And so what happened with the music industry is, before MTV existed, Jay, you and I are old enough, we remember just kind of like huddling around our radios and listening to our favorite songs. It was a monosensory experience. It was fine. We didn't know any better. But once MTV was created, it created this multisensory experience. Now I can sneak down into my family room and watch MTV on the TV screen, even though it was banned from my home when I was a kid. My parents were like, no. And I can watch it. And I'm like, all of a sudden, I'm not just listening to Madonna. I am watching her Vogue, 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 Vogue. And I also, I'm standing up in my family room and I'm dancing along. I'm trying to moonwalk with Michael Jackson. Mm-hmm. And now I'm activating all these different regions of the brain. So here's like my little, I have a Lego brain that I'm showing for those of you who are on screen with us right now. Is a Lego brain. Oh, going back to Denmark, the school that we started is just down the street from the Lego headquarters. So I did a lot of work with the Lego company. Yeah, really cool company. And so when we use multisensory instruction, we're inputting our new learning into different regions of the brain, because that's how learning happens. Life, like a lesson happens and it goes into our prefrontal cortex here in the orange region of the brain. I'm going to close this out so people can see it a little bit better. Are you okay with that, Jay?
Yeah, of course. Yeah, great.
Okay. So I'll just be brief. So information inputs right here in the prefrontal cortex, and people are like, oh, so it like goes to one spot in a file cabinet in the back of the brain somewhere. That's not how it happens. It gets broken apart into pieces and gets dispersed to different regions of the brain. So when you think back to, you know, your kindergarten teacher, the picture of what they look like is back here in the occipital lobe. The sound of their voice or sounds of what happened there are over here in the temporal lobes near the ears. And, you know, any memories of experiences and what you did there in kindergarten are up here, kind of like in the motor cortex of across the brain. And so it gets dispersed. And the reason why multisensory instruction is so, so important is that when the brain goes to remember something, the prefrontal cortex sends a signal out to the brain and says, hey, here we are in a test. And the question is about, I don't know, something, scientific notation. And so it sends a signal out to all these different regions of the brain. And each region of the brain brings back whatever it has stored there in relation to scientific notation. Now, unfortunately, most of a lot of these regions are going to come up empty-handed. Mm-hmm. That's the short version, because nothing was ever inputted into some of these places around our math content, which is why it is important. So the more regions we can activate as we're learning, the more complete and accurate that puzzle piece will be when we put it back together.
Liesl, that's making me think of something else. First, I love geeking out about the brain. I wish we could do that for hours. But people who are really good at remembering things practice remembering things. Their brains have literally gotten good at that moment where you were talking about the prefrontal cortex sending a signal, looking for the right information and it coming back. People who do that all the time get mm-hmm. really good at it.
And yeah, so, that's a reasonable practice. Yep.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Which let's jump to that because let's see here. Bring our slides back up. Well, so just for the sake of time, I want to make sure we talk about consolidation. And one of them is this idea of getting it right in space practice. Let's unpack these for just a minute, Liesl.
Yeah. So getting it right, consolidating is like getting the information to stick in the brain and getting it right. We need retrieval practices. We need constant checking for understanding to make sure that the accurate information is being reinforced in the brain. Mm-hmm. Spaced learning is all about recognizing that the hippocampus does like the spring cleaning regularly and just gets rid of stuff that's not being used or considered relevant. And so having constant touch points with content so we don't end up having to reteach everything in the spring right now around state testing time, because that doesn't feel good for anybody. And then relevant transfer is about getting it in there in a way that we still hang on to that relevance so that the information can be applied to different contexts, whether it's held on to for the next math concept or, better yet, things beyond a math classroom.
This idea of the spiral staircase and spiraling, I remember when I first learned about that, that's such a cool idea. It's like, just because I learned something in October doesn't mean I practiced it right before the test in May. It's like, nope, you should be coming to that regularly and then drawing connections. Like, you know, that multiplicative thing we just talked about, it's really related to proportional reasoning. Can anyone see how they're connected and constantly be drawing connections between the concepts we're learning with intention, right? Like, let's see how the dots connect.
I mean, like, Jay, do you remember what you had for dinner on October 4th?
I do not.
No. That's nothing. It doesn't mean that your brain is bad or broken or dumb. It means your brain was really smart and cleared that out because it wasn't important. It wasn't relevant.
And it wasn't used in a while.
Yeah, it hasn't been used. It wasn't relevant. So we need to communicate to our brains, this is relevant, this is important, hang on to it. And the way we do that is by re-engaging with that. So it's absolutely normal for students to forget things from October, unless it's been used. It's how we're designed.
Liesl, we have 4 minutes. And based on how much we wanted to talk about, we're going to have to do this again. But okay. I want to make sure, are there any just absolutely burning questions out there that people wanted to get to us? And there were a couple this question is interesting. The brain and calculators, using calculators in the math class. Got any thoughts?
I got a lot of thoughts about that.
Yeah, me too. You go ahead.
Oh, God, how do I be brief? Okay, so at a certain level, if a student doesn't have mastery of their math facts yet, I still think that's an important skill for students to develop. But at a certain age or grade level, it becomes a barrier because it's creating more cognitive load. Mm-hmm. It's using up too much cognitive space to figure out what 4 times 6 is in the middle of a big algebra problem. And so while I'm working with that student to still develop mastery, I'm probably going to give that student a calculator so that they don't get further behind. Yep. That's my quick version. Check out my Twitter threads for more thoughts on that.
Awesome. All right. Let me see about my rest of my questions here. Somebody wanted to understand more about math anxiety. How does that relate to math identity? And do you have any suggestions on what to do if somebody is sort of reached that point of math anxiety?
Yeah. So anxiety is a neurobiological state. The more you're in a state of anxiety, the more comfortable the brain feels in there. And it's almost like a wagon wheel rut from the olden pioneer days. And so the more often students feel anxious, it's easier for them to slip back into that. And sometimes just walking down the hall towards a math classroom can bring back these anxious feelings because of their past experiences. So it's important for teachers to understand what is the source of anxiety, identify what that is, and make sure not to replicate that. Maybe it's from like playing around the world or these other math games that are poorly designed. And then working with that student to help them heal from that, which is different from trauma because math trauma is different. You handle that differently. But anxiety is a state. And so you just need to help them shift their state. And there's a whole chapter all about shifting states in the book. And then also I have a whole online workshop that is all about the science, the brain science of motivational states. That would be really helpful for that conversation too. We need more time.
I know. Well, let's do some more. So this is a great segue. Somebody has the link to our follow-up page. Let's go ahead and share that with everybody so everybody has it. So your book, there'll be a link in there for your book. There will be all of the courses that you were describing. There we go. Thank you, Megan. All the courses you described. There's some free exemplar resources in there as well. For me, one of the reasons I'm so excited to interview and to talk with you, Lisa, is that I hope that Exemplars is effectively translating a lot of this cognitive neuroscience for teachers into resources you can use tomorrow, right? Mm-hmm. Like, I think of our job is to sort of read all this. And what does that mean? What does that look like? And create a resource so that teachers can just say, this really taps into a lot of those things. That research is telling us and that Liesl's telling us. So
and
that's that was why I was so excited to get you on.
Yeah, that's what I love about understanding the human brain and learning about it is because when I understand what, let's say, like motivates the human brain, then I am in a position as an educator to use my agency to choose a variety of strategies that can tap into that. There isn't a one right way or a one model or one framework or one certain number of steps that's best for students to learn. The brain is guided by these principles. And then you can look at your own personality as a teacher, but more importantly, look at your student population, their personalities, their culture that they bring with them. And then I can pick any strategy that aligns with these principles of how the brain naturally learns to make learning easier for them and more enjoyable for us as teachers too.
I think it really allows us to remember too that teaching is a really cool way to spend our lives. Like we get to create and get kids excited and we should, right? Like, and there are all of these resources that are out there that are really well thought of, but some of the most wonderful moments I had as a teacher where I'm just like, I'm just going to go for it today. Like, we're studying some laws of gravity. And I'm like, all right, stand on top of the desk and I'm going to hold up two balls and we're going to predict which one lands first. It was just totally off the cuff. Of course, the principal walks in right then. But being a teacher is such a cool way to like get kids excited and experimenting. And I want to encourage teachers to experiment. You might not get it right. You might look at the end of the lesson and be like, boy, but that was not a success. But what did you learn? And did the kids have fun? And if you've got kids having fun in your classroom, I promise you, you're winning, right? You'll get there. You'll get to that high-end learning in there. But if the kids know walking into your classroom, like, Mr. Meadows, here we go. Let's see what we're going to do today. You're winning. So have fun out there. Enjoy your kids. Get them curious.
And the more you know about the brain, the faster you'll experience success without experimenting, right? Yes. Because so many of us spend 20, 25 years playing this guessing game before we finally kind of figure out and get to our vibe of like, oh, okay, so this kind of works consistently. We can accelerate our learning with just a basic understanding of some of the principles that dictate how the brain learns and the conditions needed for it to learn. And that resource page is full of just so much. It's like a lot. So take it easy, take it slow, piece by piece. Do your own space learning with all of that and reach out. I'd love to support you and your school in any way that I can.
Lisa, my team tells me I have to end on time. I'm only 2 minutes over, so they're going to be okay with me today. So thank you, everybody, very, very much. We will be following up with an email with all those resources, and Lisa is always available. So thank you, everybody, for your time, and really, really appreciate everybody hanging out with us today. Lisa, you are spectacular. So I really appreciate your time. And we've gotten to spend some time in the last couple of weeks together. So I feel very lucky that I've gotten your time. So thanks for hanging out with me.
My pleasure. We'll do it again.
Excellent. Excellent. Okay. Good luck, everybody. Be great out there. Have fun.
We hope you enjoyed this EdWeb podcast. If you'd like to receive a CE certificate, you must watch the video recording. Recordings and quizzes can be found in the EdWebinar archives. Please visit home.edweb.net/podcasts for more information.